This is Larry Jones. You are listening to the Grace and Glory Hour with Pastor David M. Atkinson. Thank you for joining us today. We appreciate your interest and request that you pray for this ministry. Our email address is graceglory7@juno.com. graceglory7@juno.com. Now here is Pastor Atkinson.
Would you turn to Genesis chapter 31? Genesis chapter 31. I acknowledge that the introductory scripture reading will be somewhat lengthy today. I've considered it seriously, and I've come to the conclusion that I need to read all the verses we're going to read to establish the context or the setting of the account before us. Thank you for your patience. We'll start to read in Genesis 31:3. And the Lord said unto Jacob, return unto the land of thy fathers and to thy kindred, and I will be with thee. This is the command from God to Jacob. Return to the land of your fathers. Now slip all the way down to verse 17. In verse 17, we read about the obedience of Jacob. God said, return. And now we pick it up in 17. Then Jacob rose up and set his sons and his wives upon camels. And he carried away all his cattle and all his goods which he had gotten, the cattle of his getting which he had gotten in Padan Aram, for to go to Isaac his father in the land of Canaan. And Laban went to shear his sheep, and Rachel, that's one of the daughters of Laban, she is also one of the wives of Jacob, who's going to go away with Jacob. Laban went to shear his sheep, and Laban's daughter Rachel, by now one of the wives of Jacob. And Rachel had stolen the images that were her father's. The Ryrie Study Bible has this commentary on the images which are mentioned in verse 19b. They were household gods. Teraphim in the Hebrew language, in Hebrew, I am, is always the plural. These household gods or teraphim were small figurines of female deities. Charles Ryrie's notation continues. Several suggestions have been made as to why Rachel felt it necessary to have these images. Number one, possibly these images were supposed to guarantee fertility. And most of us remember how important it was in the Mideastern context for a woman to be able to conceive. So perhaps these images were to guarantee fertility. Or number two, they may have guaranteed Jacob's right to Laban's estate when he died. Though this claim may have been weakened because Laban had not voluntarily given the images. They'd been stolen. But perhaps the possessor of these images was guaranteed his father-in-law's estate. Or perhaps number three, these gods or idols were still in some sense Rachel's gods, on which she still depended for her religious or divination fortune-telling purposes. Let's pick up our reading again in verse 20. And Jacob stole away unawares to Laban the Syrian, in that he told him not that he fled. So Jacob fled with all that he had. And he rose up and passed over the river and set his face toward the mount Gilead. And it was told Laban on the third day that Jacob was fled. There were thousands and thousands and thousands of acres possessed by these respective men, Laban and Jacob. They were very, very wealthy and had large holdings to some degree spread out from each other. Verse 23. And Laban took his brethren with him and pursued after Jacob 7 days' journey. And they overtook him in the Mount Gilead. Now go down to verse 26. And Laban said to Jacob, "What hast thou done? Thou hast stolen away unawares to me and carried away my daughters as captives taken with the sword. Wherefore didst thou flee away secretly and steal away from me and didst not tell me, that I might have sent thee away with mirth and with songs and tabret and with harp, and hast not suffered me to kiss my sons and my daughters?" You have to know something about Laban to appreciate this crook, this manipulator, this conniver. "Thou hast not suffered me to kiss my sons and my daughters." Now please, verse 30. "And now, though thou wouldst needs be gone, because thou sore longest after thy father's house, yet wherefore hast thou stolen my gods?" Verse 34. Now Rachel had taken the images and put them in the camel's furniture and sat upon them. And Laban searched all the tent. That's where they were camping at that time in their return to Jacob's original land. Laban searched all the tent, but found them not. This chase went on for about 300 miles. It seems to me that this account is the original B-grade Western movie. But it can't really be a Western because it takes place in the Middle East. Or it's like a bad soap opera. They're all bad. My text is verse 34a. "Now Rachel had taken the images and put them in the camel's furniture and sat upon them." The camel's furniture, according to the commentaries, was the saddle pack. The camel's furniture was the saddle or the saddle pack. The title of this message this morning is "A Bumpy Ride on American Idols." A bumpy ride on American Idols. Matthew Poole's commentary on the images, also called gods, in this section is significant. Matthew Poole says, "They were images made in the shape of humans." 1 Samuel 19:13-16. "They were images made in the shape of humans, which the Gentiles worshipped as subordinate gods." Images in the shape of humans, which the Gentiles worshipped as subordinate gods. Genesis 31:30-32. "To which they committed the protection of their families." 1 Samuel 19:13. "And also used to consult about secret or future things, and from which they received answers about secret or future things." Ezekiel 21:21 and Zechariah 10:2. And according to Matthew Poole, these idols Laban worshipped together with the true God. This is a synthesis, this is a syncretism, synthetic, it's a together situation. These idols, says Matthew Poole, Laban worshipped together with the true God. It's a conglomeration. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown cannot bring themselves to say that what Laban and Rachel did with these images was really worship. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown disagree with Matthew Poole. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that these images were only used as talismans for superstitious purposes. But I see worship. I see worship, even as Matthew Poole sees worship. You say, well, Pastor, why do you see worship? Why do you disagree with Jameson, Fawcett, Brown and agree with Matthew Poole? Well, the passage clearly indicates that both Laban and Rachel had an inordinate, unbecoming attachment to these images. In fact, they couldn't live without them. And that sounds like worship to me. They couldn't live without them. It was worth a 300-mile chase. Now, Laban, sneak that he is. If you think I'm unkind about Laban, study every reference to Laban. You understand why I call him a manipulating sneak. Laban tries to put a higher, more noble construction on his 300-mile pursuit. I really wanted to kiss my girls goodbye. Now, doesn't that sound sugary sweet? But he does finally get around to the issue that sets the stage for the entire incident, and he finally gets round to the images or the idols. He wants to make himself look the best he can look. So he says, I really wanted to kiss my family goodbye. But while we're talking about it, where are my images? And one of the things you need to keep in mind when you interpret the Bible is the law of first mention. Often in Scripture, when an element is mentioned at the beginning, it is to color the whole account. And way back near the beginning, in verse 19, the beginning of this whole incident, the images are mentioned as setting the stage for this whole account. The images are not secondary. The images, the gods, are very primary to what's going on in the chemistry of this chase. Tim Chester, to whom I am indebted for much of the application of idolatry to contemporary American life, Tim Chester gives us several simple definitions of idolatry as it relates to the contemporary North American living. Tim Chester says, an idol is anything we look to instead of God for living water or ultimate satisfaction. Good definition. An idol is anything we look to instead of God for living water, which speaks for ultimate satisfaction. Tim Chester also says, idols are the things we believe we must gain or keep from losing in order to be happy. Oh, that puts the corn down where everybody alive in 2011 can understand it. Idols are the things we believe we must gain or keep from losing in order to be happy. Laban thought he had to get them back and he was going to be happy. Rachel thought she had to have them if she was going to be happy. And I add this comment of my own. Our idol is who or what we depend upon in the minutes and hours of everyday living. Our idol is who or what we depend upon in the minutes and hours of everyday living. I'm not trying to make light of investing in the stock market. I'm not against that. I'm not against investing in the stock market. But I will say, if we turn to the stock market pages in the Wall Street Journal, before we go to our knees when we're hurting financially, then we've got an idol. An idol is what we depend upon when we come to the bottom line of push coming to shove. That's what an idol is. An idol is that in which our hopes and dreams are wrapped up in. That's what an idol is. An idol is what we're counting on to get us through. Our idol is what we intuitively go to when we're facing pressure or difficulty. The Bible condemns idolatry. Idolatry offends the only true God. Idolatry insults God. But idolatry not only insults God, idolatry harms man. I would submit to you that the attachment of Laban and Rachel to these images or idols harmed them both. Idolatry insults God and harms man. If you have an idol, it's not for your good. You may love your idol. You may sleep on your idol. But your idol is not for your good. Your idol is intended by the enemy of your soul to hurt you. Your idol is intended by the enemy of your soul to cause you to become addicted. To be no longer free, but a slave. That's what Satan's intention is for your idol. Turn over to Genesis 35. And we'll try to take a brief look at idolatry in the Bible. We can just scratch the surface. Genesis 35, 1. Genesis 35, 1. And God said unto Jacob, arise, go up to Bethel and dwell there, and make there an altar unto God that appeared unto thee when thou fleddest from the face of Esau thy brother. Go and make an altar to the true God who appeared to you and helped you. And let's see Jacob's response, verse 2. Then Jacob said unto his household and to all that were with him, put away the strange gods. He had been told, go up and build an altar to the only true God. And his instant response was, as he instructed his loved ones, put away the strange gods that are among. If we're going to worship the only God, we must predicate the worship of the only true God on the basis of the putting away of strange or false gods. And be clean and change your garments and let us arise and go up to Bethel. And I will make there an altar unto God who answered me in the day of my distress and was with me in the way which I went. Jacob understood where his dependency should lie. Jacob understood where his attachments, his allegiance should lie, not to strange gods or idols. He understood that his allegiance and his dependence should belong to the only true God. On what are you depending? Do you have a strange God? Let's continue to look at a brief overview of idol worship in the Bible. We turn to Exodus. Exodus chapter 20, verse 3. Exodus 23. And let's read verses 3 through 5 in unison. We will be reading, please, in unison. Exodus 20, verses 3 through the end of 5. The first two words are, thou shalt. Let's read together. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image, or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. Thou shalt not bow down thyself to them, nor serve them. For I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generation of them that hate me. Now turn to Exodus 23. Exodus 23. Exodus 23, verse 24. Would you please listen? God is speaking to Israel. Thou shalt not bow down to their gods, nor serve them, nor do after their works, but thou shalt utterly overthrow them and quite break down their images. And ye shall serve the Lord your God. And he, underline he, the pronoun refers back to the Lord your God. And he, the Lord your God, shall bless thy bread and thy water. And I, it's the Lord speaking, and I will take sickness away from the midst of thee. In verse 25 says, the Lord, you will depend upon me for your bread. You will be attached to me for your water. You'll depend upon me when you're sick. You'll not depend on idols or small g gods when you need bread or water or healing. You'll depend upon me. You'll be attached to me. I believe that according to chapter 23 and verse 25, sections B, C, and D, the worship of the true God may be defined as God dependency. The worship of the true God may be defined as God dependency. What God insists upon is attachment to and dependency upon Him. I'm going to say it one more time, and then I invite you to try to say it with me. We may say it several times. Let me say it one more time. What God insists upon is attachment to and dependency upon Himself. Now say it with me. What God insists upon is attachment to and dependency upon Himself. Let's say it one more time. What God insists upon is attachment to and dependency upon Himself. Thank you. Anything less than that indicates some form of idolatry. Now, I'm not just speaking to the time of Laban and Rachel. I'm talking to us. He hath showed thee, O man, what God doth require of thee. And what God asks of thee is attachment to and dependency upon Him. Will you please listen to me? It's no different with you or me. What God insists upon is attachment to and dependency upon Him. And if you're not living that way, you're in idolatry. Oh, you say, well, I don't have a little statue of a human form on a shelf in my house to which I bow and kneel. If you're depending upon anything or anyone but God, you're an idolater. You say, well, give me the New Testament. I'm so glad you asked. We will look at the New Testament. Turn, please, to Matthew 4. Matthew 4. Matthew 4, verse 8. And let's once again read in unison. Matthew 4, 8 through 10. We are coming to Matthew 4, and we read in unison verses 8 through 10. Let's read together. The first word is again. Again, the devil taketh him up into an exceeding high mountain, and showeth him all the kingdoms of the world, and the glory of them, and saith unto him, all these things will I give thee, if thou wilt fall down and worship me. Then said Jesus unto him, get thee hence, Satan, for it is written, thou shalt worship the Lord thy God, and him only shalt thou serve. There's an exclusivity of service. I repeat, there is an exclusivity of service. Thou shalt worship the Lord thy God, and him only shalt thou serve. Am I serving popularity with the local Independent Baptist Fellowship? Is that what I'm serving? Am I living for and dependent upon the approval of my brothers in the Northern Indiana Independent Baptist Fellowship? If I'm doing that, I'm an idolater. If you are dependent upon pornography, you are an idolater. If you have to have pornography, you are an idolater. If you have to have booze, I say with arms stretched out to love you, if you are dependent and have to have booze, you are an idolater. If you have to have drugs, you are an idolater. You are not content to depend on God alone. You must have fill in the blank to be happy. Or content. The Bible is very direct on what idolatry reveals about a culture and what idolatry predicts for a culture. I need to say that again. The Bible is very direct on what idolatry reveals about a culture and what idolatry predicts for a culture. And if there's not a drastic turnaround in the United States of America, we are headed for collapse. Our idols predict and prophesy that we're headed for collapse. The social fabric of this nation is disintegrating. At least 50% of all marriages end in divorce. There are millions and millions and millions of children and teenagers who are being reared in this nation in the instability that results from the idolatry of one or both parents. Idolatry is ripping this nation to pieces. Idolatry is multiplying nervous breakdowns. Idolatry is breaking up marriages. Idolatry is landing young men in jail. Idolatry is taking money that should be used for food and spending it on porn. Idolatry is taking money that should be used for appropriate beverage and wasting it on inebriating substances. Idolatry is doing all those things and a thousand things more. This nation is collapsing because of her idolatry. Idolatry reveals emptiness. Idolatry reveals emptiness, and idolatry predicts internal weakness and collapse. It reveals emptiness and it predicts internal weakness or vacuum and eventual collapse. If you're weak on the inside, you will eventually collapse. Idolatry predicts eventual collapse of an individual or a nation. For decades, American idol worship was hidden. Now it's overt. We've had it for decades. But now it's overt. It's so overt now that, yes, we name a TV program after it, American Idol. And Baptists watch that and don't see the contradiction. What is happening to us? The word idol ought to evoke instant concern in the heart and mind of any Baptist or anyone who professes to be a Christian. It's now very overt. I'm quoting from a USA Today cover story. The byline is, "The sweet smell of excess." The sweet smell of excess. And it talks about people bidding for the dirty socks of celebrities on eBay. Section D, page 1, USA Today, February 4th, 2005. Three tablespoons of water, said to have been touched by King Elvis at a 1977 concert, sold on eBay for $455. Someone else paid thousands for a guest appearance by the cup, the styrofoam cup that held that water. And the cup made a guest appearance at someone's party. And that someone paid thousands of dollars for an appearance by the styrofoam cup that Elvis touched when he had access to that water that was sold to somebody else. In recent years, someone paid nearly $1,500 for a billiard ball from King Elvis's pool table. A hanging macrame plant holder from Graceland, complete with a plastic fern, went for $633 because Elvis was once near it. And someone else paid, even more, $748 for a tree limb that mysteriously fell to the ground during Elvis' funeral at Graceland. Yes, a superstition is connected to it all. Someone paid $748 for a limb that fell to the ground during the king's funeral. The article says, there are a lot of bored and lonely people out there. Or perhaps this phenomenon is a grotesque manifestation of the celebrity worship syndrome. The newspaper said it wasn't a Baptist pastor. Perhaps this is a grotesque manifestation of the celebrity worship syndrome. Once you start becoming addicted to having to have information about your favorite celebrity, you need more and more extreme things to feel connected, and you're prepared to pay more and more for it. It's an addiction. It's idol worship. Kurt Cobain. Nirvana, was it? Kurt Cobain, the rocker, shot himself. Out west, an empty hair color bottle used by Kurt Cobain sold for $175. That's idolatry. Number one, I don't hate his memory. It's obvious even he wasn't content with himself. Nor was the buyer content with himself or herself. $175. for the empty hair color bottle. Justin Timberlake. Oh, you remember that name, don't you? Of Super Bowl halftime infamy. His partner was Janet Jackson. It has absolutely nothing to do with color. This has absolutely nothing to do with color or race. Justin Timberlake, Caucasian. Janet Jackson, African American. They appeared together, halftime, Super Bowl, you know, costume malfunction. Remember that? Well, Justin Timberlake made another mistake. Back in 2000, he appeared on a New York radio station and he failed to finish the French toast he was served while he was being interviewed. And the partially eaten toast sold on eBay for more than $3,100. He forgot to finish his toast as he was interviewed on the radio station. That's idolatry. That's worship of gods. A price for one of John Lyric's linens was $1.2 million. The original. $1.2 million for original linen Lyric's. I could go on and on and on. I will come to something that happened very recently. I believe I read it this past week in the Wall Street Journal. Remember a man by the name of Jack Kevorkian? Yes, Dr. Jack, also called Dr. Death. He was the doctor of so-called assisted suicide. And in the Wall Street Journal, there was a picture of his machine with the containers set up, and you just push the buttons and... Dr. Jack taught you how to be selfish, because that's what suicide is. It is the height of selfishness. The person who commits suicide, and let me say, I'm not going to be unkind. There are reasons for why I'm saying these things. The person who commits suicide cares about himself or herself more than anyone else on the face of the earth. It's the ultimate act of selfishness. Dr. Death, Dr. Jack Kevorkian, only has one surviving ear. And there was to be, or is to be, an auction of the paintings of Dr. Death. And the paintings of Dr. Jack Kevorkian will bring millions of dollars, including the painting which he painted with a pint of his own blood. Sick. Or what? Sick or what? I don't have to continue with evidence of American idolatry. Let me give you a couple quotes, then I'll make the application, and I will need to stop. Martin Luther said, "A God is whatever we expect to provide all good and in which we take refuge in all distress." A God is whatever we expect to provide all good and in which we take refuge in all distress. Whatever you set your heart on and put your trust in, that, I tell you, is your true God, said Martin Luther. Richard Keys said, "Idolatry may not involve explicit denials of God's existence or character, but idolatry may well come in the form of an over-attachment to something that is in itself pretty good. An idol can be a physical object, a property, a person, an activity, a role, an institution, a hope, an image, an idea, a pleasure, a hero." An idol is anything that's a substitute for God. Tim Keller said, our idols are those things we count on to give our lives meaning. But if I just get the remnant of Justin Timberlake's piece of French toast, I'll be happy. Just get that. One more property. One more hit. One more platinum. And so they destroy themselves trying to get one more platinum. Now, Tim Chester says, the New Testament way of talking about idolatry is sinful desires or lusts. Literally, it's the lust of the flesh. Lusts here is not just sexual desire. I repeat, it's not just sexual desire, although it would certainly include sexual desire that's out of control. But lust in the New Testament includes all sinful desire. Got to have more and more and more. Just one more. Just one more. One more high. One more million. Someone asked one of the wealthiest men in the world, how much money does it take to satisfy? And he said, just a little more. Just a little more. Your idol is whatever you're greedy for. It may be money, approval, sex, or power. Now let me make this very practical. And then I'll be done. Rachel went for a bumpy ride on American idols. How can I know if I've got an idol? Well, five things in my life reveal or unmask my idols. Five things in my life reveal or unmask my idols. Number one, my anger. And may I speak as lovingly and as kindly as I can? You would help yourself if you take some notes. Some of you have idols and you don't even realize it. You're never contented. You're never satisfied. You're not satisfied with your job, your marriage, your children. You're not satisfied with anything about you. And what I'm going to give you right now from Tim Chester will teach us how to identify our idols. My anger reveals my idols. Now, with each one of these five, there'll be a question that goes with it. My anger reveals my idols. And here's the question. What do I want that I'm not getting? What do I want that I'm not getting? I just want some respect. And that's why I'm angry. I just want a bigger this. I want a bigger that. And that's why I'm angry. My anger reveals my idols. What do I want that I'm not getting? The second thing that reveals my idols is my anxiety. What am I anxious about? The Bible says, be careful or anxious for nothing. Be careful or anxious for nothing. If I fear losing this church, if I fear that the deacons are going to dismiss me, and if I'm anxious about it, then this church is my idol. And I'm not worshiping God first. I'm worshiping this church and my friendship and fellowship, or perhaps my paycheck. what is it that kicks me into instant anxiety? Worry. Oh, if that happens, and that happens, and if. And the question that goes with number two, my anxiety, is this. What is being threatened? What's being threatened? My place on the totem pole? My adrenaline glands? My high? What's being threatened? Around what do my anxieties and worries coalesce? The third thing that reveals my idols is my despondency. My despondency. What gets me down? What discourages me? And because I want us all to come to grips with this morning, I will be very transparent. And this may be my end here, but if it's my end here, I'll go being honest. I was taught in the 1970s that you are not a successful pastor unless you have growing attendances. I was taught that you have to get on the list of at least 200 baptisms per year. I was taught that you're only significant as an independent Baptist pastor if you have X number of people baptized in a given year and you have the crowds increasing and increasing and increasing all the time. And so, the thing that tempts me to be despondent is when the crowds are dwindling and we're not getting statistical results. That's my idol. What's yours? I have an idol that tempts me. What's yours? Well, don't look so pious. Don't look so spiritual. You too are tempted to have idols. And it's the worship of the wrong thing. When I go home on Sunday night and Jane says, well, what's your take on the day? What's your take on the day? And I say, well, we had 85. We had 85 tonight for the evening service. And I wish it were more. And so I'm despondent and I'm discouraged. Statistics have become my idol. What's yours? The question for my despondency is, what have I lost or failed at? What have I lost or failed at? I have failed at having a high attendance. And I'm despondent because I have failed at having as many baptisms as I've been taught you're supposed to see. My despondency relates to what I've lost or failed at. And I'm discouraged. I'm despondent. Because I have constructed an idol. What must be to make me less than a failure and to keep me from being discouraged or despondent? The fourth thing that tells us what our idols are is my stress. My stress. My stress reveals what my idol is. And the question for my stress is, what outcome or result am I trying to avoid? What outcome or result am I trying to avoid and thereby bringing stress upon myself? Well, the worst thing a pastor can do is not have 200 baptisms a year. That's the worst thing a pastor can ever do. The worst thing a pastor can ever do is not just be giving away motorcycles and cars and getting the statistics up. It's the worst thing that could ever happen to a pastor. When I think that way, that increases my stress and that reveals my idol. There is a very real sense in which your stress is trying to say something to you about your idol. We are not stressed about things that we don't value. And if we're stressed constantly, we need to change our value system. I said, if we're constantly stressed, we need to change our value system. And then the fifth and final thing in my life that reveals my idols is my daydreams. My daydreams. What do I find myself daydreaming about? Now, there's a difference between a daydream and having a vision. We need to have biblical goals, not goals that are superimposed by the Baptist brethren. And some of the goals we had in the 70s were superimposed, sincerely superimposed, but superimposed with short-sightedness. Some of the goals were Baptist brethren goals, not Bible goals. You'll find some very small churches in the Bible. Find some very small churches in the Bible. But my stress, my point of stress, may well indicate what my idol is. And my daydreaming, instead of having a biblical vision, may reveal my idols. And the question that goes with number five, my daydreams, is where do my thoughts go or escape to for joy or comfort? Where do my thoughts go or escape to for joy or comfort? It is called escapism. Too much daydreaming is a form of escapism. Oh. So he dreams about that other woman. She daydreams about that other man. Or he daydreams about how just one more joint would make everything right. Just one more look. Just one more look would be the ultimate high. So we go from softcore porn to hardcore porn, and it gets more and more expensive. What I daydream about can reveal what my idol is. And that to which I run or try to escape when the pressure's on may also tell me what I'm worshiping. The poet, hymn writer, said, "The dearest idol I have known, help me to tear it from my breast and worship only Thee. The dearest idol I have known, help me to tear it from my breast and worship only Thee." That's a bumpy ride on American idols. Do you have one? Do you have several? It's idolatry. And those idols, those gods, are never going to satisfy you. You will die reaching for just one more. Just one more high. You'll die that way. Because you're worshiping idols. Oh God, the 70s happened a long time ago. It's been a long time since the 70s. But I confess and I acknowledge with sadness and shame that I am still sometimes tempted to despondency because of humanistic goals and the expectations of men that are not met. And I confess that it is idolatry when I decide whether a Sunday has been a good Sunday or a bad Sunday based on how many were present. It is idolatry when I determine whether a Sunday has been a good Sunday or a bad Sunday on the basis of how many were present. That's an idol. Help me to continue to tear that idol from my breast and instead to worship only Thee.
We trust you have been encouraged or strengthened by the Word today. We would love to hear from you. You can email us at graceglory7@juno.com. That's graceglory7@juno.com. We will reply to all those who contact us. And now, until next time, may the good Lord bless and keep you.